In 2014, 15-year-old James Okina encountered the problem of out-of-school children living on the streets in the southern Nigerian city of Calabar, where he lived, and James decided to do something about it.
I would speak to people with so much passion in my voice. Like, I mean, it couldn't have just been me. Like, this is so wrong. Why is an 8-9-year-old on the streets by themselves, fending for themselves? We have to do something, right?
He started a campaign to encourage more people to do more to help these forgotten children. Unfortunately, his campaign did not go as planned.
And everyone I talk to will listen to me with, you know, keen attention, nod their head, and they'll say to me, well, what you're saying is so true. Like, this is terrible. Everybody had some variation of the same thing. But what is the government doing? But what is the church doing? And the more I heard it, the more frustrated I got. Like, I mean, there's a 9-year-old kid in front of me. What do you mean by what's the government doing? What do you mean by what's the church doing? Why can't you be the priest on the streets?
So with little help on the horizon, James decided to start something on his own. And his experience doing this will change his life forever.
16th of June 2016, I was 16 as well, when a child died in my arms. But that was the first time it happened. Unfortunately, it wasn't the last time it was going to happen throughout our work. But his name was Nduke. Was a brilliant kid. He had overdosed on Tramadol. And when I found him, he had been lying unconscious for almost 2 days. Rushed him to the hospital in time for him to die. My hands kept shaking for a long time. After that, I'd never seen somebody take their last breath. It's a very weird experience to experience in general as a human being, and even more so as a teenager.
And this traumatic experience was just the beginning of what would become one of Nigeria's most impactful social enterprise that would save the lives of thousands of children and transform James into one of the youngest social entrepreneurs in the international development space. Welcome to Decline Podcast, where we tell extraordinary stories of the African youth.
My name is James Okina. I was born in Calabar, Nigeria, went to nursery, primary, and secondary school, the first part of my university education in Calabar, Nigeria as well. I'm a social entrepreneur. I'm super passionate about at-risk and indigent children.
James Okina is an accomplished social entrepreneur who has dedicated the better part of his life to positively impacting the lives of children living on the streets. His incredible life story begins in the southern Nigerian city of Calabar.
I grew up in Calabar, Nigeria with both of my parents. For the first 9 years of my life, they were together. And those first 9 years, like, they were quite uneventful in the best way possible. I have two brothers. I have half siblings, but primarily grew up with two brothers, one older, one younger, brother from both of my parents. And it was like I said, it was uneventful in the sense that it was go to school, come back, be a good kid, eat, do well in school. That was kind of it.
Unfortunately, as James turned 9, his routine and sheltered childhood will be disrupted as his parents filed for divorce.
Well, my parents separated when I was 9, right? My older brother was, I think he was 14. He had to be about 14 or 15 when they separated. It was a very tumultuous period. It wasn't smooth at all for us. It wasn't smooth for them. So they separated in 2008. maybe somewhere around, I want to say July, somewhere around the summer break. And we first moved in with my mom. And a few months later, my dad came asking for custody for myself and my older brother. So my younger brother stayed with my mom. He would only join us a few years later. But when we moved in with my dad, it was really tough. My dad was never around. So one day we're super sheltered. The next day we're completely responsible for ourselves. You know, we go to school by ourselves. We come back from school by ourselves. We have to find what to eat by ourselves. Nobody say do your homework, take a nap or whatever. So one day your life is very regimented. The next day you are an adolescent with all this freedom and you don't know what to do with it.
So the separation of James's parents had brought with it a period of unsupervised freedom, a period that would come to be known as the darkest part of James's young life.
So I turned to vices for a sense of belonging. I started hanging out with the wrong group of students in school. I went to a pretty decent school. This was when I was in secondary school. I went to a pretty decent school. I started hanging out with the wrong people. And I was a very bright kid, but I went from top of the class to bottom of the class overnight. Didn't care about my academics. The sense of belonging that I was missing at home, I found it with the wrong crowd. We went shoplifting, we would scale the school fence, and we would do that. We'll go there, we'll go to shops, I'll go back home, throw my school bag, go and find the friends that I had on the streets. And it was the same thing, you know. If we're not vandalizing property, we were stealing, we're just up to no good, right? And I think the one word that comes to mind when I think about explaining that period of my life was that it was dark. Like I was very lost. And there were times where I can vividly remember, I was a shadow of myself, right? Like I remember one day in school, I'd stolen something from another student and I got caught. And they're just parading me on campus, on the school's campus, like, oh, this student got caught, is going to get punished. And I remember just being so, it was like an out of body experience. It was like I was observing what was happening, but very numb to all of it. So that must have continued for 4 years, from JS1 till SS1.
And after 4 years of a difficult and troubled childhood, things began to turn around for James when he encountered a relative who helped him discover his purpose in life.
I had a cousin. His name was Tochi. At the time when he came, he had moved from Lagos to Calabar to study. He had gained admission to the University of Calabar, computer science department, and he had moved in with us. You know, for it was going to be a temporary arrangement until he found housing. He ended up living with us throughout his time at the University of Calabar, which was an amazing gift for my life, because he modeled, he represented everything that I wasn't and everything I wanted to be. His discipline, his attitude, he was the most giving, loving person that I'd ever met. I think he must have been 18 or 19 at the time he moved in with us. He was very well put together, the way he spoke, the way he addressed people, the way, and I just admired him so much from afar. The more I got to know him, the more I got to know his backstory, what life in Lagos was like. And I'd always plague him, like I'd never been to Lagos at that time. So like, what is life in Lagos like? I, you know, of course, read all these books, read all these stories about, you know, the hustle and bustle of Lagos. And if you've been in Lagos and Calabar, you know that they're worlds apart. They're not anything like each other. They're like two different countries. So I wanted to, you know, get into his mind a little bit and know what Lagos was like. And then he began to tell me about how he found a sense of purpose from, you know, reaching out to communities. And when he said that, it struck a chord so deep inside me, because all those years that I'd spent doing the wrong things, There was a voice deep down inside me. I knew that I could be more. I knew that I was made for something more.
So with this realization, James started making conscious efforts to turn his life around.
So I began to volunteer. I joined an after-school academy called iCapture Networks, where I met another person who became an important block on my path. Her name is Gracie Hedemaizupo in it. She was a very important figure in my life when I met her, and the exposure. And one thing led to another. And like they say, the rest is history. But I began to meet people. I met my first mentor through the after school academy. His name is Mr. Joseph Edet. All of these mentors and stakeholders in my life almost now began, they almost served as a barrier between me and where I was coming from. And that was it. In a span of, I want to say, a year, it was difficult for me to even recognize myself. I had moments where I'll sit in my room and just cry. And just cry because of how helpless I felt months ago versus where I was at the moment.
And in 2014, the newly reformed and purposeful James took his greatest step yet when he established Treat Priests, an organization dedicated to helping troubled and disadvantaged children living on the streets.
So actually it was 2014, I was 15, when I started Street Priests. I'd met a kid, his name was Frederick. At the time, he must have been 2 years younger than me. And he was so talented. He was athletic. He knew how to play the guitar. And he spoke very well. And so I just engaged him in conversation. And he told me, he said, I live alone. I could not wrap my mind around it. What do you mean by you live alone? What do you mean by you don't have where's your mother? Where's your father? What do you mean by yourself? Could not wrap my head around it. At this time, I just graduated out of high school. I was working in the marketing department of my mentor then, Mr. Joseph Edet. It was a clothing company. So I decided to befriend Frederick. So every day I will go to work. I'll buy him breakfast. I'll go to work. On my way back, I'll get dinner with him. And then I'll give him money for breakfast the next day. And if he was hungry and he had lunch, I'll pay for lunch when I get back from work. And at first I did that hoping to catch him in his lie, hoping that one day I'll meet his mom. I'll see his mom and say, oh, like, you know, yeah, you were lying, but it's cool. Like, I mean, he was cool. So I thought it was cool. And weeks turned into months and I never saw his mom or his dad. Like, this boy was really living alone. I could not understand it. And I became his primary caregiver. Between meals and, you know, I'll take him to events, you know, sometimes he would join me to work, but he wasn't going to school as well. So, and it was very brilliant. He himself told me, I want to go back to school. I want to go back to school. Please, please help me go back to school. And I remember looking at him and thinking, I was like, Frederick, I mean, remember I was 14 and I told him, I said, Frederick, I can't promise, but I will try. I'll try. I was 14 or 15 at the time. And I tried and it was good enough, right? And I was able to get him back to school. I was able to enroll him. And then he brought his friend Kelvin. At the time, he had a friend who was also in a similar situation. Kevin had parents, but, you know, they didn't care about him. He wasn't in school. He was out of the house, you know, most days of the week, whenever he went home, which is one of the issues of why children end up on the streets. When you mix poverty and poor parenting, it becomes a big problem. So Kevin was in that kind of situation. Kevin wanted to go back to school as well when he saw that Frederick was in school. So I was able to get both of them back in school. At that time, my thoughts were, okay, this is it. Like, this is it. I'm not taking any more kids back to school because it took a lot as well. At the time, and this is also how the name Street Priest came about. At the time, all that was on my mind was, I would talk to adults and adults would do something about this. And I would speak to people with so much passion in my voice. Like, I mean, it couldn't have just been me. Like, this is so wrong. Why is an 8, 9-year-old on the streets by themselves, fending for themselves? We have to do something, right? And everyone I talk to will listen to me with, you know, keen attention, nod their head, and they'll say to me, well, what you're saying is so true. Like, this is terrible. Everybody had some variation of the same thing. But what is the government doing? But what is the church doing? And the more I heard it, the more frustrated I got. Like, I mean, there's a 9-year-old kid in front of me. What do you mean by what's the government doing? What do you mean by what's the church doing? Why can't you be the priest on the streets? And that's how the name Street Priest was born. Was born out of frustration, was born out of an idea that the individual could do something about it. And today we talk about it all the time. Street Priest is not an organization, it's an idea. If one person decides they want to do something about, you know, children on the streets, then they're street priests. And so that's the idea that propels us today. But that's how it all started. I met more kids on the streets after I got Frederick and Kevin, you know, back to school. And one thing led to another. I just couldn't turn, right? Like, I thought I was cursed because I felt like people who could see these kids look away, go about their day, go about their business, I thought they were blessed. I thought they were blessed because I couldn't sleep. I was a 14, 15 year old. I would stay up at night trying to write up ideas. Some nights I'll just like cry into my journal because of what I had saw the day before. And I saw terrible things. So I thought I was cursed because I couldn't look away. Like I could not. And I wanted to. For the life of me, I wanted to. It was too much a burden to bear. And it was, most importantly, it was too much a burden to bear alone. So that was how, you know, the necessity to do more gave birth to the structure around the organization. I began to talk to people about sponsoring some of my programs, and they would say, oh, are you registered? Are you this? So I began to look more and more into that. I began to look into building a team. I began to look into incorporating, getting a logo. So one thing led to another, and it was almost as though necessity demanded that we're more structured, we're more organized. And that was how, you know, everything else unfolded.
And just like that, Street Priests, James's incredible dream that would help transform the lives of thousands of street children, was born. I asked James what it was like building a social enterprise as a 14-year-old.
It was very lonely. It was very, you know, character defining. In a way, I didn't have my teenage years. In a way, I didn't have the normal teenage experience, you know, because of this. I was everything. I had to learn to do everything. At some point, I was a graphic designer. At some point, our first ever documentary, I shot and edited it. I was a photographer. I learned by error a lot of times, but I learned quickly. There were a lot of great experiences. I remember the first time we were able to fundraise and give scholarship to, I believe, 100 kids at once. Must have been one of the most, my hairs are standing just saying it. I was 16 at the time. It was beautiful. I remember when we put together our first concert. It was a back to school fundraiser. And man, like, just to reminisce on those days, like, I mean, it was very precious memories, a lot of great high points, you know. I remember when we got our first grant of $10,000. I was 16. My goodness, top of the world moment. I had received an award called the Future Africa Leaders Awards by the Future Africa Leaders Foundation. And we'd gotten a grant of $10,000. Another super high point, right? I remember when we put together our first, made our first reunification, reunited the child back with their family. I'll never forget, the dad cried like a baby. One of our amazing success stories.
But amidst the great successes, there were also low points and difficult moments that reminded James why he needed to continue what he was doing.
But there were also some low points, very low points. 16th of June, 2016, I was 16 as well, when a child died in my arms. One of the lowest points in terms of, like, I mean, till today, was, I still think it's a tragedy that could have been averted. But that was the first time it happened. Unfortunately, it wasn't the last time it was going to happen throughout our work. But his name was Nduke. Was a brilliant kid. He had overdosed on tramadol, and when I found him, he had been lying unconscious for almost 2 days. Rushed him to the hospital in time for him to die. My hands kept shaking for a long time. After that, I'd never seen somebody take their last breath. It's a very weird experience to experience in general as a human being, and even more so as a teenager. I remember another kid, Justice. He had been so sick that I was scared he was going to die. Again, I was around maybe 16, 15 at this point. I was scared he was going to die. And despite him puking on me, I carried him on my back, found the nearest pharmacy, because there's no time to waste, and we got him food. We were able to revive him and nurse him back to life. And then he was later on adopted by a magistrate who was a patron of our work. So there were lots of, moments. I could go on and on, in these years, but it was very interesting to see how the organization even grew. Those first 4 years were really a one-man army show. But towards the end of the first 4 years, from 2014 till 2018, we began to grow. We had a board of directors, we had a team. Everyone was still on a volunteer basis. We had maybe, I want to say, 60 to 70 volunteers at the time, in 2018. We'd done so many significant things. A lot of tabloids had covered our work. We're gaining lots of momentum, and we're very, very visible in the community.
So for almost a decade, James and his team as street priests have impacted the lives of thousands of children across Nigeria. And James's work with disadvantaged children has taken him from the shores of Nigeria to many other countries. Today, at the age of 23, James is the program manager at Florida's Lane University's Watson Institute, where he trains other young people from across the world to become changemakers in their own community. What could be more inspiring than that? So before I let him go, I could not help but ask James what would be his advice to other youngsters across Africa looking to become changemakers in their own communities.
Right now, based on my present commitments, for example, as program manager, Watson Institute at Lynn, I'm charged with the responsibility of training the next generation of entrepreneurs, change makers, etc. And they come from 16 countries on 5 continents and 11 states in the U.S. Currently, my whole role right now is helping people be young people, be change makers. And with my current program, it takes 3 years. So that's a loaded question because there are a lot of moving pieces. But I'm going to attempt to answer that question the way one can answer that question in a few seconds to minutes. I think there are two things that are important. Number one is you need to fundamentally understand this, that as a young person, one of the most powerful resources that you have, if you're young, you're already halfway there. You don't know enough to be scared. And you, that's why you have to protect your mind from people who are older, from, telling you, you can't do this. Listen, like Dr. Sue said, if you say you can, you're right. If you say you can't, you're right. And that's why one of the world's most renowned poets said something very striking. He said, youth is often wasted on the young. Because if you're young and you're still thinking, maybe I can't do it, you're wasting time. You're wasting time. If you get anything from my story today, it is that as a young person, it's possible. If anybody can do it, you can. Look at everything that's important in the world. It has been done by a young person. Like social media, all the social media giants, they were founded by young people. All the things that have taken over the world are young people. So if you're sitting down thinking, oh, I'm too young, you're wasting time. Like, the age doesn't matter. So the two things I would say is just start. a lot of times, you know, what holds us back is fear. Feel the fear and start. Feel the imposter syndrome and start. Feel the inadequacy and start. So act in spite of how you feel. Start. The second thing that I think will be very important, and whether you are 16 or you're 25 or you're 35, something that will be super helpful if you decide to start on a journey like this is that you have to be humble. You have to be humble. It was Quincy Jones who said, "Dream so big, you can't have an ego. It will get in the way of everything, because the only thing that can stop you is you. And if you let your ego get in the way, it will get in the way of working with people, it will get in the way of raising money, it will get in the way of getting people on board. One of the things that I learned very early is that you have to be humble enough to allow the vision guide you. You have to be humble enough to learn from people. You have to be humble enough to admit that you've made a mistake. You have to be humble enough to switch directions and courses where it's important. Pride is not your friend, it's your enemy. You have to be humble enough to burn the proverbial midnight candle. Learn what you need to learn. Change what you need to change. You can't say, okay, this is how I am. I'm always an angry person. You know, the work will demand something else from you. And which brings me to my final point. If you think that you, as in the way you are right now, is going to change your community, change your nation, change the world, you are out of your mind. You have to be humble enough to allow the process shape and change. Is a very good friend who said something, Kennedy Akazie. He says, keep your identity small and flexible. That means don't get hung up on, oh, this is why I am this. No, keep your identity small and flexible. Let your that vision be a steward of your vision. Let it shape you, let it guide you. Because the most important thing is not even what you're going to accomplish. It's about who you're becoming. It's about who you become through the process. So start and be humble enough to let this vision lead you to wherever it's going. That will be my response to that question.
This episode of the Climb Podcast was hosted and edited by Joel Atadobright. Special thanks to James Okina for allowing us to tell his story. The Climb Podcast is a podcast collaboration between the Channels Media Group and the Firoz Lalji Institute for Africa at the London School of Economics and Political Science. Thank you for listening.